From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Johnny Carson's the star, but when The Tonight Show is on the air, Fred DeCordova calls the shots. He tells Carson when to break for a commercial and when to bring out the next guest. Since 1970, DeCordova has been executive producer of The Tonight Show. Fred DeCordova is our guest on this edition of Fresh Air. Also today, part two of our conversation with Penelope Spheeris. Her documentaries, The Decline of Western Civilization, explore the worlds of punk rock and heavy metal. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the long-awaited new album from Patti Smith, and film critic Stephen Schiff has reviews of two summer comedies, A Fish Called Wanda and Midnight Run. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Johnny Carson needs no introduction, but my guest Fred DeCordova probably does. Since 1970, Fred DeCordova has been the executive producer of The Tonight Show. He once described his role as chief traffic cop, talent scout, number one fan, and critic all rolled into one. DeCordova was 60 by the time he joined The Tonight Show, and he was already a seasoned movie and television veteran. He directed many films, probably the best known of which is Bedtime for Bonzo, starring Ronald Reagan. On television, his credits as producer or director include The Burns and Allen Show, The Jack Benny Program, and The Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour. DeCordova has written an autobiography titled Johnny Came Lately. Its publication is putting the variety show producer into the guest seat for a change. I spoke with him from the NPR Bureau in New York. I asked him where he sits during the taping of The Tonight Show.
Well, Johnny sits behind the desk that you've all seen often. And then there's the couch. And at the end of the couch, in a chair, an uncomfortable chair, which gives me a perfect view of Johnny's eyes and vice versa, I am there about 12 feet away from his nibs.
So you're really sitting very close. Now, you
right.
say in your book that you function as a sounding board when the going gets rough. Would you explain?
Well, I think after all the years that Johnny and I have worked together, I have a pretty good read on his reactions to what's going on, and he sometimes looks at me for verification, like it's going well or not, and those are just little minor eye moues. And I also have on my left, which is one of the most vital and compelling parts of television, a button, which means it's time to go to commercial. And although most of the world loves to get up and go to the bathroom, it's my ability to get up and go over to Johnny and say, this is going great, or why don't we go to the next guest?
So when you press that button to go to a commercial, are you sometimes doing that to bail out of a tough spot?
Yes, I think that's... let's not say a tough spot, but one that isn't going quite as well as we hoped it would.
Now, you're making this all sound very calm and organized. I want to read a quote from what Robert Blake said to Kenneth Tynan for the Kenneth Tynan Profile of Johnny Carson in The New Yorker some years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So this is Blake talking about what it's like to be a guest on The Tonight Show. He says, you better be good, or they'll go to the commercial after 2 minutes. The producer, all the federales are sitting like 6 feet away from that couch, and they're right on top of you, man, just watching you. And when they go to a break, they get on the phone, they talk upstairs, they talk to Christ, who knows? They talk all over the place about how this person's going over, how that person's going over. They whisper in John's ear. John gets on the phone, and he talks. And you're sitting there watching, thinking, what are they going to hang somebody? Then when the camera comes back again, John will either ask you something else or he'll say, our next guest is. It sounds crazy.
Well, it's a little more controlled than that. There is a phone, me to the booth. There is no phone next to Johnny. We have to do evaluating, and as you do in your business or anybody else, whether something is good enough or exciting, amuses Johnny and amuses the audience. Those are our two goals. Whether it's going well enough to go to the next guest or to say, let's go a little longer with this man or woman. And then there is also the terrible problem that if you go too long with a couple of your guests, you have to say that, we're terribly sorry that so-and-so isn't with the show tonight, but we hope we'll have time the next time. So you don't like to bump people. But that, again, is dependent on how much the audience and how much Johnny are being amused.
So you're not worrying about hurting a guest's feelings while you're making these decisions?
Yes, I am. But we do start out with the fact that everybody gets paid whether they go on or not, and not that it's a munificent sum. But it is almost a guarantee that if that person is available in the immediate future, that person will be on and not be the last guest.
I'm speaking with Fred DeCordova, who has been, since 1970, the executive producer of The Tonight Show, and has written an autobiography titled Johnny Come Lately.
No, Johnny Came Lately.
Johnny Came Lately. Gosh, you know, I've been reading a Johnny Come Lately to myself all this
time.
Well,
you should be ashamed.
Now, you're watching the show as it happens. I always imagined you being in your office watching it on TV so that you could see what it's actually like as a program, where it would look really different than it would in real life.
Is that a question?
Well, I guess, do you run back afterwards and actually watch the broadcast to see how it looked on TV?
No, but all our shows are on tape, and if there's anything that strikes me in the actual course of the show that could have been improved or could have been handled differently, I certainly run that tape the next morning. Since we do a show, we tape it at 5:30 in the evening for airing that night, there isn't much time to do any fixing. Since obviously the 5:30 show ends at 6:30, which is 9:30 in New York. And so our errors, if they exist, and of course they do from time to time, are there for the world to see. But we try not to make them twice in a row.
Well, no guest gets on the show without your approval. What's the pecking order in terms of the lineup for the evening? How do you schedule what the lineup is?
I think you try to, if you go way back to vaudeville, or even in a book, you try to mix your show so that there aren't all musicians, all authors, all camera freaks, or all civilians. You try to mix it so that the audience, and we know it's a vast one, gets a little bit of each possible area of entertainment. The normal running order would be the star, the comedian, the musician, and that goes sometimes in another area. We have...
And then the book author, right?
The book author is the bumpy, ordinarily, yes. I've bumped myself twice in the last 2 weeks.
You know, I was wondering if you were going to go on and plug your book on the show.
I certainly put my name up there, and since those guests are chosen by me, there that name was. But then the writers went on strike, and I've had to bump myself twice.
Huh. Now, you know, The Tonight Show has all these rituals that accompany it. I mean, the show opens exactly the same all the time, and it has for years and years. You know, Ed McMahon, if he's there, starts it, does the whole here's Johnny, does the whole hi-yo, and then, you know, bows to Carson. And then there's the banter between Carson and the band leader and Ed McMahon. Do you know how any of that started?
Well, I was a young child at the time. But I believe it was what all you want to acknowledge, the fact that Johnny is there, that Ed is that person, and Doc is that person, and the band is available. I think you do what people, and I don't want to sound being psychologically involved with The Tonight Show, but I do think that people have learned that The Tonight Show is what it has been the night before and the night before, not necessarily in subject matter, but that they, as they get into bed and turn out the light, ending that day, they see what they have seen and what they've enjoyed seeing for so long. I also believe that the people, the shows that have tried to scramble the format, the talk variety format, are among the quickest to leave.
So you think it's a good investment to just keep those rituals there all the time, have it be predictable?
I think if you kiss your wife good evening when you come home and goodbye when you leave in the morning, that's a ritual that should be continued, and that's in a sense what we're doing.
Another kissing ritual is when a woman guest is on the show, she has to kiss Johnny before sitting down on the couch.
She doesn't have to.
But she always does, right?
She also lifts the left leg and bends it to the back, and I don't know why they do that either.
Are there frequently newcomers who are just in shock about being on the show because they've watched the show for the last 20 years of their life?
You can tell, and their eyes betray them. There are lots of people who come on for the first show, and some who come on for the 50th time, who you can see their eyes dancing, and that they're just fine backstage. They're laughing and enjoying themselves. They come through that curtain, and you can see them freeze on the way over to that famous chair. But he does everything he can, and he's very good at it, Johnny, to try and ease into an interview so that it doesn't come on strong, like, hey, how is your new picture doing? He's liable to say, what a pretty dress, or if it's a man, what a pretty suit. He tries very hard to put people at ease, and I believe he's a master at it.
Johnny Carson is better known than the President of the United States is. You know what I mean? He's just so recognizable. He's so well-respected. Everybody knows him. Everybody watches the show or wants to be on the show. You're in the position of being the executive producer of his show. Is it hard to tell him your opinion when his opinion differs? I mean, since he's such...
Well, I've been there.
Since Johnny Carson. I know you have.
No, I was pointing out that I wouldn't be there if I kept pointing out that my opinion was different than his. We do have, and this is no self-analysis. I knew Johnny long before I did The Tonight Show. When I was doing the Benny shows, he was on several occasions one of our stars. We have, from the very beginning, had rather... similar reactions to people and things. And in the 18 years that I've been doing this job with him, I think our opinions have become even more closely attuned. So it isn't really liable to be a series of arguments about how did you book this person or why didn't you book this person. We pretty well know what we're thinking as we think together.
Now, you sometimes do the warm-ups, don't you, before the show starts?
I sure do.
What are some of the stories you use for that? Do you do shtick when you're warming up the audience?
What a thing to say. actually, it's some jokes that I've learned over the years are non-topical and will last forever, and I indicate that this is one of those rare nights when Mr. Carson actually will be hosting the show, and I point out that... it's important for people in the audience to know each other, so if everybody in the audience, when I count three, will turn around and shake hands with the person directly behind them, it'll all make it a friendly group. And I count one, two, three, and they all turn around. Of course, everybody is faced in the opposite direction. So that's the kind of intelligent, bright thing I do.
How do you usually go over?
Well, they're glad to be in out of the rain, and the price is right. It's pleasant, and the strange thing happens that even as a behind-the-scene person over the years, so many times Johnny has chatted with me on the air, that there is some kind of recognition that it is somebody truly connected with the show who is out there making a fool of himself.
Are there any shows that haunt you?
No, and I think I can explain why and not take too long in doing it. Our show is kind of like a baseball team in a baseball season. If you do one show a year or one show every 3 months or one show every 4 months, you have an awful lot of time to realize what a failure you've been. But we do kind of a baseball season. We do a show one night, and then we hope it's wonderful. And if not that, we hope it's good, and we hope it isn't bad. But even if it's a great show or even if it's not such a good show, we do another show the next night, and we have no time except in self-analysis to decide why it wasn't good or even why it was very good. We just do the next show and hope that that'll be a good one.
You had lots of TV experience before joining The Tonight Show. You were the producer of Burns and Allen show for a while on TV. That always struck me as a very, almost like an experimental video show. You know how, of course, you know, how George Burns always used to watch the action on his TV monitor? What a very inventive idea for a program.
Indeed. I knew George and Gracie from vaudeville when they did an act called Lamb Chops. And then I knew them, of course, on radio. Then when the time came, and parenthetically, the time has always come perfectly for me. Certainly somebody has been watching over me because I had... some sizable success here on Broadway, and just when that, I think, was about to end, somebody suggested that I direct motion pictures, and I did that at a couple of studios. And each time the success was bigger at the beginning than it was at the end, and just when I think the motion picture said, we can do without Fred, television came along, and Burns and Allen and December Bride and the Bob Cummings Show and all those wonderful years with Jack Benny and My Three Sons. And then again, here I was having an absolutely wonderful time when out of the clear blue sky somebody said, Carson is looking for a new producer and think you might be that person. And all has blended together into a remarkable long period of time. So, if that's long-winded, to get back to George and Gracie, George, who is his own head writer, has been most perceptive, most knowledgeable in what will make people laugh, and understandably so, after all of those years in vaudeville. So we took the vaudeville act of George and Gracie and moved it into radio and then into television.
You know what I've always wanted to know about Gracie? How did she feel about always having to play the part of the stupid person? Because all the jokes were based on her not getting the joke.
Oddly enough, when the vaudeville act started, George was a comedian and Gracie was the straight lady. And they didn't get any laughs that way, so they switched it around. And she felt just fine. She absolutely adored George. She enjoyed working. She knew that she was playing a part, and so I think did the public, because she was a very bright and knowledgeable young lady. So it was, you know, like Lucy didn't always trip and fall down, and Jack wasn't really miserly. I think the public recognized that they were playing characters. And she lived a very happy life with George, two children, and enormous success before she left. And isn't George remarkable after all these years to having the kind of career he has now?
Well, I want to talk with you more about other shows that you've produced on television, about your movies as well, including Bedtime for Bonzo. But first, we're going to take a short break. My guest is Fred DeCordova, who has produced The Tonight Show, the executive producer, since 1970. And he's written a memoir which is titled Johnny Came Lately. We'll talk more after this break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Fred DeCordova, executive producer of The Tonight Show and author of the new book, Johnny Came Lately. Now, you directed the film Bedtime for Bonzo, one of the very many films that you directed. Now, when you were working on it, I'm sure that, A, you never expected Ronald Reagan to become the president, and, B, that you never expected this movie to be revived as an example of the most absurd part of the President of the United States' career. Did you really like the film when you made it, or were you thinking of, oh, this is just an assignment and then it'll sink without a trace? What was your attitude toward the movie?
Well, in order of your questioning, I have never thought that anybody I was directing was going to be the President of the United States. yes, it was a regular program picture. Mr. Reagan, Ronnie, as I knew him then, was workmanlike, talented, inventive, and helpful actor. We thought the script was rather good, and so were the notices. I don't think a lot of us thought it would become one of the major discussionary items of political history, but I think both the president and I have seen it recently, or comparatively recently, and turned to each other and said, well, now what's all this fuss about? It was a pretty funny picture, and I think it was.
Was it ever hard for you to accept Ronald Reagan as President of the United States after you directed him as an actor?
No, not really. Ronnie had been the president of the Screen Actors Guild and was a studious and caring man, always. I think it was a surprise when he became governor, and he did such a good job as a governor of California. It didn't particularly surprise me that he would be presidential fodder. I know that in the White House, we were at a state dinner, Janet and I, Mr. Cordova, and after the toast of the dinner, we went to, walked through the White House before we went to hear Itzhak Perlman do some violin playing, and the president was talking to some people and called me over, and he said to those people, ladies and gentlemen, this is the man who is totally responsible for my being president of the United States. And a few eyebrows went up, and they turned around, and he said, yes, sir, ladies. If he hadn't directed me in Bedtime for Bonzo, I'd still be in motion pictures and somebody else would be here.
Do you ever feel guilty when Johnny Carson tells Reagan jokes in the opening monologue, since the president is a friend of yours and a former colleague?
I think the answer is yes. But I also think that I've been there. He's made presidential jokes about every president since he's been on the air. I think those jokes come from a recognition that almost any politician, president more so than most, of course, is fair game. They chose that career, and if they do something silly or something that seems silly, or make a mistake, if Ford fell down, or Jimmy Carter's a kind of way of talking, I think that the comedians immediately are attracted to the front page.
I'll tell you, just as a sidebar here, with Carson, I always get the feeling that the political jokes don't necessarily represent his politics at all, but rather the politics of the writers.
No, not in disagreement with you. I don't know, after all the years and all the time I've spent with Johnny, whether he's a Republican or a Democrat, I have no idea.
Oh, really?
I think he's totally apolitical. I think, the monologues are written by writers and very talented writers, and Johnny. Johnny will, at that 10 o'clock call that I mentioned, that he calls me every day, I'm liable to get a point of view of what he has read in the paper. And I find it absolutely astounding that he seems to say on the air on, let's say, Tuesday, what the public, after hearing him, seems that they have felt all along on Wednesday. He's a real leader of public opinion, I believe.
My guest is Fred DeCordova, who's the executive producer of The Tonight Show, has been that since 1970. He's also written an autobiography titled Johnny Came Lately. We have to spend some time talking about your parents. Your father was a con man, and a very theatrical one at that, and made his living doing some some pretty underhanded things.
Well, I think you phrased it nicely. That's exactly what he did. He was a dear man. He came up with a number of scams that since then have been tried by other people. I think he kept the ball in the air longer than most.
Well, tell one of the scams that kept you alive when you were a child.
Well, one of the famous pyramid scheme was really attributed to a man called Charles Ponzi, which is where you promise a high rate of interest and then keep paying that high rate to the people who put in the money first. And you don't really invest the money. You just keep taking money from the newcomers and add to the proceeds of the earlier investors. And Charles Ponzi once said in my presence that he, Ponzi, had gotten the credit and the jail time for doing what my father had really invented. And I think today it's kind of has still exists in the form of the pyramid schemes.
Well, you also moved from hotel to hotel as a child, right?
Only when necessary.
Uh-huh.
Father and mother would live, and I must give mother credit, she was a very able assistant in these schemes. You lived in the highest style you could, and rather lavishly. And then when money kept coming in, you just continued to live at the sunspots of the world. And then if money stopped coming in, you began signing more checks rather than paying for them. Remember, this is long before credit cards. And there was a time lapse between the time you did something that you shouldn't have and then anybody discovered it. And then we would move, leave a forwarding address, say we were dissatisfied with the service in that hotel, we're moving elsewhere, and please send the bill to us and don't hold us up because our auditors will be upset. And then we would wait until some money came in from some other new scheme to pay off the thing and start all over again.
Were you ever asked to play a starring role in any of these schemes?
No, sir. My father was totally ashamed of what he did. And from a earliest age that I can remember, although I didn't know really why, he absolutely insisted on my being scrupulously honest. And nobody wants to go through life looking over his shoulder at what trouble may be catching up to him. I did have the fun of the last 20 years or so of their lives of calling them together when things got pretty good for me and say, now I know what's been going on. It's over as of now. From now on, you're my mother and my father. You're retired people, and there'll be no more of this. And I don't think I ever saw two more relieved people in my life.
When you were a kid, what did you tell your friends that your parents did for a living?
Oh, it depended what I thought he was doing. I did not know.
You weren't in on this at all?
Oh, no, 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 no. Oh. I thought he was an agent of the government. I thought he was an Internal Revenue man. I thought he was an explorer for the Baedeker guidebooks. It depended on whatever part he was playing, and I just thought he was very talented, and I'm a talented man.
I must say, your childhood must have been the perfect rehearsal for a show business career.
I think so. I think I got to meet a lot of people under a lot of circumstances that normal young men wouldn't have.
And you learned to recognize a swindle when you saw one.
Not every time, but I'm a little more wary than most people.
You have been producing The Tonight Show since 1970.
Right.
Now, before you got there in 1970, in the 8 years preceding that, there were four different producers. Obviously, none of them lasted for very long, whereas you've been there for more than 17 years. Do you have any ideas of what made them go so quickly and what made you stay so long?
No, I don't. I do know that at various times I had... Those producers and I, three of the four of them, have crossed paths, and I thought all of them were very talented and very nice. And the man who was my immediate predecessor, a young gentleman called Rudy Tellez, I think had every reason to be terribly disappointed that he was terminated. But he waited around for the first 2 weeks or 3 weeks of my arrival on the scene and made everything as easy for me, told me everything that he thought would be of value to me. And instead of any mean-spirited attitude, he made my arrival on the scene a very happy and a very pleasant one. And I'm happy to say that he does very well now in another line of business.
If you don't mind me bringing this up, you're, I believe, 78 now, and Carson's in his 60s now.
Oh, gosh.
And everybody's always asking Carson if he's going to retire. What about you? Are you planning on retiring at all?
When he does.
Uh-huh. Do you have a pact or something?
No, I think we have this, that we're going to keep on doing this till I'm 100 and he's 82. He has a specific comment, and I think it's the total wrap-up of his attitude. He will keep on doing The Tonight Show as long as it is number one and as long as it is fun for him. And I believe that at no time in the history of The Tonight Show has the separation between The Tonight Show and any other talk radio version or talk variety version of a show ever has the separation been as wide. I think it is a more successful show now than it ever has been in the past. And as long as it stays like that, and he has fun doing it, and I believe he does, I know that he, more than most people, revolves his whole life around The Tonight Show. It is fun for him. It is hard work, but it is fun. I think we'll be around for a while.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us. Thank you very much.
Well, you're a delight.
But
everybody
you.
Says that.
Fred DeCordova has been the executive producer of The Tonight Show since 1970. His autobiography is titled Johnny Came Lately. It's published by Simon & Schuster. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with David Watts. He studied the mountain gorillas in Rwanda, Africa, at Diane Fossey's research center. He became director of the center after Fossey was murdered. Watts recently acted as intermediary between the gorillas and the actors and film crew who were in Rwanda to make a feature film of Diane Fossey's life, starring Sigourney Weaver. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional funding comes from World of Travel Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner, designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Fresh Air receives additional support from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Filmmaker Penelope Spheeris grew up in a carnival family. As an adult, Spheeris has filmed some freakish acts for her two-part documentary, The Decline of Western Civilization, on the punk and heavy metal music scenes. Coming up in part two of our conversation, Penelope Spheeris tells us about documenting youth culture and about her own coming of age. It's been 9 years since Patti Smith released her last album. Her fans' long wait is finally over. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of Smith's new album, Dreams of Life. And film critic Stephen Schiff gives us his views of two summer comedies, A Fish Called Wanda and Midnight Run. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Sharon Green. Both houses of Congress today approved drought relief bills. There were only 29 dissenting votes in the House, while the Senate approved the measure 94-0. The package contains $6 billion in aid for drought-stricken farmers. Details from NPR's Cokie Roberts.
Congress considered the drought relief bill amid warnings from the Reagan administration that the lawmakers were in danger of busting the budget. Budget Director James Miller today pointed to several popular pieces of legislation awaiting action. In addition to drought relief, there are measures to help the homeless and the hungry and to add ammunition to the war on drugs. Miller said those bills could cumulatively send the deficit higher than the amount agreed to in the bipartisan budget summit last fall and require an automatic across-the-board cut in federal programs. Democrats claim the administration is playing politics with the deficit, trying to embarrass the democratically controlled Congress. And lawmakers of both parties insist that the measures are fiscally responsible as well as politically popular. The drought relief bill provides assistance to farmers who lose more than 35% of their crops from natural causes this year and gives additional assistance to those who lose more than 75%, but no one farmer would receive more than $100,000. I'm Cokie Roberts at the Capitol.
Wildfires still rage through six states in the West and Midwest. Officials in Rapid City, South Dakota today evacuated residents of three subdivisions as a precaution against an encroaching arson forest fire. In Wyoming's Yellowstone National Park, damp conditions slowed a backfire intended to divert one of seven major blazes scorching sections of the park. Fires also burned in Alaska, Montana, Idaho, and California, where hundreds of thousands of acres have been blackened. An Israeli delegation arrived in Moscow today, the first diplomats from Israel to visit the Soviet Union since the Kremlin broke off ties during the 1967 Middle East War. NPR's Ann Cooper reports.
The Israeli delegation said it hopes the trip is a first step in renewing formal relations with Moscow. But no Soviet officials were at the airport to greet the delegation, which includes Jews who've emigrated from the Soviet Union. And a Soviet spokesman today pointedly downplayed the visit, saying the Israelis would only be dealing with technical issues and not paving the way for renewed diplomatic relations. The Soviets issued two-month visas to the delegation, which will inspect the abandoned Israeli embassy in Moscow and review visa procedures at the Dutch embassy. Dutch diplomats have represented Israeli interests here since 1967, including issuing visas to Jews emigrating from the Soviet Union. I'm Ann Cooper in Moscow.
4 days of informal Cambodian peace talks ended today in Indonesia. A closing statement said the participants had reached broad agreement on the need for a political settlement and that they had set up a framework for continuing negotiations to resolve the 9-year-old Cambodian conflict. But sharp differences remain. The Khmer Rouge guerrilla leader accused Vietnam of trying to perpetuate its occupation of Cambodia through what he called its puppet regime. Representatives of Cambodia's Vietnam-backed government participated in the talks, along with three guerrilla factions and members of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. The U.S. Commerce Department today reported a 0.7% increase in personal income last month. At the same time, consumers boosted their spending by 1%, in large part because of higher prices. On Capitol Hill, meanwhile, Federal Reserve Board Chairman Alan Greenspan said that it would be better for the central bank to err on the side of restraint rather than permit easy credit and a return of runaway inflation. Greenspan also told the House Banking Committee that he did not foresee shortages of workers that would lead to pressure for sharp wage increases. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 28 points today to close at 2082.32. You're listening to NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Before Patti Smith was a rock star, she was an avant-garde poet in New York who gave readings accompanied by electric guitar. It's been almost a decade since her last album. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of her long-awaited new one called Dream of Life.
Speak to me.
Now there's a voice we haven't heard in a while, in nearly a decade, in fact. Patti Smith, one of the most complicated and ambivalent rock stars ever, has returned with an album that accounts, to a certain extent, for her long silence. Dream of Life is full of that distinctive stuff we might call Patti poetry. Lyrical non sequiturs, extravagant emotions, symbolism gone surreal.
Where there were deserts, I saw fountains like cream, the waters rise, and we stroll.
That's the first single from Dream of Life called People Have the Power. It's a surging, upbeat song that combines Smith's utopian optimism with her sense of populist radicalism. As such, the song harks back to her earliest impulses as a performer. She came to prominence in the 70s, first as a published poet and then as a singer of poems placed in a rock context. But Patti Smith has always had the air of a hippie, and I don't mean that in a derogatory way either. As a working-class bohemian, Smith's hippie style is rooted in a tough-minded, streetwise intelligence. She talked on and on about being influenced by the French poets Rimbaud and Verlaine as much as by Jimi Hendrix, but in some ways she was America's answer to John Lennon, a cynical rocker who despised sentimentality while indulging a fondness for the most romantic sort of avant-garde art.
United children, shine.
By the end of the 70s, Patti Smith had attracted a sizable cult following and scored one top 10 hit, a florid interpretation of Bruce Springsteen's Because the Night. Then she married a musician named Fred Sonic Smith, who is most famous as a member of the MC5, a politically minded hard rock band from the 60s. She moved to Detroit with Smith, and they had two children. The role of mother would seem to be an intriguing one for Patti Smith, who has always portrayed herself as a dreamy street urchin. But anyone sifting through the lyrics of Dream of Life for clues to Smith's reaction to parenthood is bound to be disappointed. The closest she comes to this is The Jackson Song, a lullaby written for her son, Jackson.
And in your travels you will see warrior wings remember daddy. And if a mama bird you see folding her wings.
I'm afraid that much of the rest of Dream of Life is as mawkish as that very sincere song. Smith's singing on this record is very good. She's obviously become a much more polished vocalist during her absence from the recording scene. But technical accomplishment doesn't count for much in rock and roll, and the truth is that with her pretty singing and pretty melodies, she's also become something of a bore whose songs natter on aimlessly. Smith was always capable of going on for too long, but her earlier sprawling compositions, such as Radio Ethiopia, at least posed a legitimate challenge to her audience. Those songs implied that if you liked her image and her voice, you also had to grapple with her frequently garbled but always provocative ideas. On Dream of Life, however, all of Patti Smith's ideas are used up after people have the power. The rest is just nice music.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer.
Sun is rising on the
This is Fresh Air. Yesterday, we talked with filmmaker Penelope Spheeris about her latest music documentary, The Decline of Western Civilization, Part 2, The Metal Years. It's a companion to her punk rock documentary, The Decline of Western Civilization. Besides documentaries, she's also made rock videos and feature films. Her film Suburbia was about runaway punk kids growing up alienated in the suburbs. Today, we talked to Spheeris about documenting youth culture and about her own experiences growing up. Spheeris told me that she's fascinated by youth cultures, especially by their music.
I look at music like it's a signal of future trends, you know? I mean, I noticed in the 60s that music would always bring up elements that you would see like 5 or 10 years later. So if that be the case, we're going to be one party in country here with this metal going on.
Have you become a surrogate mom to any teenagers whose own parents don't understand their lives and their music?
No, I've got my own daughter, and I don't really have any urge to be a surrogate mom to anyone else.
Is your is your daughter part of any of the music scenes that you've covered?
Oh, well, she goes out to clubs and, you know, watches. She's a fan of a lot of the music, yeah. But generally, I like harder music than she does.
That's a switch.
I know, it is. Well, I've had a harder life than she has. I think that's where a lot of it comes from, you know. A lot of kids that are into metal have come from dysfunctioning families, and they kind of, you know, go for it to you know, have a new identity, you know.
They said you had a harder life than your daughter has had. Can I ask you a few things about your own background?
Sure.
Now, you grew up in a carnival, right? I think your father was a strong man in a carnival?
Right. I was in the carnival until I was 7 years old, at which point he was murdered, and we sold the carnival. And so after that, I lived in various states and places, living in trailer parks and, you know, kind of a poor white trash kind of a family, you know.
Was he murdered by someone in the carnival?
No, he was murdered in Troy, Alabama by a man who... Well, there was an argument. My father was protecting a black man and that worked for him, actually a black kid, a 15-year-old kid. This guy had hit the kid. My father went to ask him to leave, and the guy just pulled out a gun and shot him. And because it was an argument over a black man and my father was protecting this black kid, the guy did not go to jail. So he murdered him and didn't ever pay for it. So I have a kind of a distorted view of the American justice system.
Hmm. When your father was alive and still performing in the carnival, what was his act like? Do you remember?
Yeah. I don't know how this... Actually, maybe it does relate to heavy metal. I do remember one thing my father did. He put chains around... One chain around each of his arms and then attached the chains to bumpers of cars. And the cars would try to drive away, and my father would hold them there, and the wheels would spin and everything, and that would show how strong he was.
Wow.
Uh-huh.
To me, there really is a connection to heavy metal in the sense that there's so much kind of costuming in heavy metal. It's
very theatrical.
It's very theatrical
in the
way that a carnival is, yeah.
Yeah, and that's why, I really think that these PMRC people and
PMRC is the Parents Music Resource Center, the group that opposes violent and sexual imagery in album covers and music lyrics.
In a very radical way.
Uh-huh.
One thing that I found really interesting when we did the film was that, Ozzy Osbourne, for example, is the fear of the PMRC and parents who don't understand the music. But the way Ozzy looks at it and the way I look at it too, actually, is that it is very theatrical. You know, Ozzy thinks about himself as the Vincent Price of music, you know? Yes, he has bitten the head off of a bat. However, he thought it was a rubber bat, you know? Nobody was more bummed out about it than he was. He had to get rabies shots, you know?
Oh.
But it is very theatrical, and I think for people to be afraid of it is just proof that they haven't faced in an honest way their own fears that they have about life in general. They just attach it to heavy metal music, you know?
Well, this brings to mind another connection between the carnival and heavy metal. And that didn't Alice Cooper bite off the heads of chickens in his act?
Yes, I think he might have.
But, that's the whole geek act from carnivals.
Oh, that's very true. Oh, my God, I think we've stumbled across something very profound here, Terry. Let's get the rights to the book.
Yeah,
no.
I don't know. It just seems to me, though.
It's true.
I can see a certain relationship emerging here.
Yeah. You know, and the freakier it gets, the more money you make, you know?
How did you get interested in movies?
It was an identity. It was an escape for me. It really... that was it for me when I was, 10 years old. I would go to the movies incessantly. I would walk from one movie theater to the other one and see movies all day on Saturday and Sunday, you know. It just kind of took my mind off of not having a very happy home life, I think.
Now, you've directed documentary films about the punk music scene, the heavy metal music scene, and you've also done feature films, narrative films, about similar kinds of people, you know, like Suburbia was about a group of punk kids who basically leave their parents and form their own community in an abandoned house in the suburbs. When you're directing fiction films on youth culture type subjects, is it hard to make the fiction measure up to the reality when the reality is already so extreme?
Yes, it is. And I think that's why you very seldom see it work in films, and I think that's why people generally, directors and filmmakers, try to avoid it, you know? It's really funny. I get requests from major, major million-dollar salary film directors to get prints of my films and screen them so that they can do research on what kids are really like. And I think to myself, why don't you just go look, you know? But, yeah, I think generally Hollywood is, you start making so much money in this town and you don't go out on the street. You don't find out what's really happening, and it's reflected in the films, you know?
Well, it really is true that both movies and television shows have had an immensely hard time accurately portraying any youth culture that I can remember.
Yeah. A lot of it also has to do with the fact that generally those people who are in control of what will be produced look at it as a threat to their own existence to acknowledge or give any credibility to an up-and-coming young movement, you know? It, in a way, it says, you're on your way out, you know?
Uh-huh.
And so, therefore, they kind of like to keep making films that have to do with their own sensibility and their own realities, and that way it kind of makes them live forever, if you know what I'm saying.
Well, I've been to a few rock concerts where I knew I was among the older people there.
Yeah.
And, you know, I can't say that it bothered me, but I did notice it. And I was wondering if it ever made you feel awkward going to a club where you were, you know, by several years the oldest person there.
It, well, made me feel awkward. Now, most of the time when I go to clubs or concerts, I go for research, you know. Even if it's my own, you know, just personal research and seeing what sort of trends are happening or where kids are at, you know, even if it never even gets into a film or a letter or an interview, I go out of curiosity. Secondly, I go to be entertained, but first I'm a sociologist in a way, you know. I love to watch this behavior. And also now it's sort of interesting because they know who I am. And I walk through a crowded club and I get my hand shaken and patted on the back and thumbs up, and you know. So that's kind of nice. And anyway, they're all going to get old someday too, so forget it, you know.
Okay. Take good care.
Thank you. I really enjoyed the interview.
Filmmaker Penelope Spheeris, her new film is The Decline of Western Civilization, Part 2, The Metal Years. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. We'll check in with Renee Montaigne, co-host of the show, who's joining us from Washington. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What stories are you covering?
Well, Congress today is debating a bill to provide billions of dollars in drought relief for farmers. Now, it's one of a number of bipartisan efforts that have come out this summer. This bill is popular in Congress, but it will have rough going if it does get to the White House. Also, a secret speech made by Nikita Khrushchev some 30 years ago, highly critical of Stalin, has been published in Poland, and we'll have a report on that. And the controversy over the pumpkin papers revive. That's the farm where Whitaker Chambers dug up the documents used against Alger Hiss in his Cold War perjury trial has been made a national landmark, and that sparked a new controversy. We also speak with Alger Hiss.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Besides the mega action films in movie theaters this summer like Die Hard and Rambo 3, there's also some lighter fare. Midnight Run teams up the unlikely pair of Robert De Niro and Charles Grodin. A Fish Called Wanda is directed by Charles Crichton, who's best known for his comedies in the 1950s with Alec Guinness. Our film critic Stephen Schiff has a review of both.
I have a weird question. Would A Fish Called Wanda and Midnight Run be better if the acting in them was worse? A Fish Called Wanda is a crime farce in the spoofy black comedy style of the 50s Ealing Studios pictures. In fact, the Ealing director Charles Crichton, who's now 78, directed it. But his civilized tone tames whatever outrageousness the script once had. The wittiest writing comes in this scene, between Jamie Lee Curtis, as the double-crossing femme fatale, and Kevin Kline, as the crook who hopes to whisk her and a cache of stolen diamonds off to Rio.
Don't call me stupid.
Oh, right! To call you stupid would be an insult to stupid people! I've known sheep that could outwit you. I've worn dresses with higher IQs, but you think you're an intellectual, don't you, ape?
Apes don't read philosophy.
Yes, they do, Otto. They just don't understand it.
Jamie Lee Curtis is terrific in this movie, partly because she's not all that skilled an actress. She delivers the lines and the winks and the double takes, and doesn't bring anything more to the party than is absolutely required. But Kevin Kline is too much actor for his sketchy role. He gives the character more traits than the script can handle, and in the end, all we get is a noisy blur. Likewise, the magnificent John Cleese, who makes his dull barrister entirely too subtle and touching, and Michael Palin, who can do 80 funny things at once and is wasted doing only one. The acting in A Fish Called Wanda makes you want to follow the characters to places this flimsy little movie can't take you. It makes you long for what should have been. On the other hand, the acting in Midnight Run makes you long for a different movie entirely. This action comedy was directed by Martin Brest, who made Beverly Hills Cop, and it has the same galumphing chase with laughs formula. This time we get Robert De Niro as a bounty hunter and Charles Grodin as the persnickety accountant he's dragging from New York to L.A. The movie is painfully familiar, all explosions and gunfights and the usual dumb repartee in which one guy eats hot dogs and the other guy tells him how bad cholesterol is. The trouble here is that Grodin is a splendid comic actor who can combine amazing ordinariness with amazing craziness. Here he's allowed only his amazing ordinariness. You ache to see the Grodin hiding just off screen. And then there's De Niro. Listen to a single line of his. He's just been picked up by a gaggle of FBI agents, all of whom are wearing sunglasses, and all of whom want him out of the way.
Can I ask you something? These sunglasses, they're really nice. Are they government issued, or do all you guys go like to the same store to get them?
Now, when De Niro says, these sunglasses, they're really nice, he's blowing the gag. The gag is that he's talking about the sunglasses, not about the serious subject at hand. And the longer he natters on after the sunglasses are mentioned, the more the joke loses its steam. In short, De Niro's comic timing is off. He's never as funny as the movie needs him to be. Yet, by the end, he's brought astonishing shades of anxiety, conflicted morality, and hidden grief to a character who, as scripted, is little more than John Q. Tough Guy. It's an amazing performance. What a pity that the movie encasing it is Midnight Run.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair and is a contributing correspondent to West 57th.
Here's a look at the next fresh air. Next time I'll speak with Pat D'Inizio, lead singer of the rock band The Smithereens. Some critics have called the group's music retro rock, a throwback to the 60s. D'Inizio says their music belongs firmly in the 80s. Also, Chicago-based singer and songwriter Bonnie Kolak returns in our weekly performance spot, and critic Ken Tucker reviews new home video releases, including Near Dark, a horror film Ken says was unjustly dismissed as just another slasher film. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistance from Ed Doherty. Our engineer is Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon and Lisa Bruton directed today's show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.